Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So I wonder, are we going to still say Pirates and Penguins when the kids are grown and we're still doing this podcast in 10 years? And
we're going to still be doing this podcast in 10 years?
I am sure we're going to be doing this podcast in 10 years.
Okay.
We'll talk about our grandkids in 10 years.
In 10 years.
God forbid. No. That would be, Belle will be 23. That's within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, that's true.
We'll see. It's hard to imagine. Anyway, let's talk about what we've been doing the past week since our last time behind these microphones.
What have we been doing?
I got jury duty summons.
Woohoo!
There are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who never get called to jury duty, and then there are the people who get called immediately upon their availability the next time, you know, when the exempt period lapses. Actually, I have to say, the last time I was called was 5 years ago. But this is like the fourth or fifth time I've been called to jury duty. Once in Lawrence when we lived up in Salem. I lived in Salem. And once in Brockton, Quincy, and now this time in Dedham. And there was one time where I couldn't go because they called me when I was in school and living in Ohio. So that's like five times.
I've actually reported to jury duty like in person twice. I think I've got like the summons, but then like had it canceled by phone call or email a couple times.
I did have it canceled a couple times. The one in Brockton, I think, got canceled.
Yeah.
The thing about the jury duty, like you got called once when you were nursing a child, right?
Yes. I was nursing Lucia. Not only that, she was exclusively nursing, and did not take bottles or anything. And there is no exemption in Massachusetts for nursing moms.
Right.
What I found out, and I could not find anything on the summons for like who to call or how to notify them if you were like deadly ill and couldn't make it, or like had a sick child and couldn't make it. Like there was nothing. So what I ended up doing was packing the baby with me, even though I knew that they would not be happy to see me showing up with a baby, but I had no way of contacting them. And she actually was sick at that time. Like there was no way I was leaving a sick, exclusively breastfed baby at home with you while I was gone all day.
Right. And I had to take a time off from work to stay home with the kids.
So the officer of the court was very nice. And she, showed me how to like
defer,
get a deferment. And so, but you could only defer for a year.
Right.
But as I recall, when the year came up and I was up for jury duty again, that was when one of the times when they just got a phone call or an email or something saying that they didn't actually need me to serve.
And that was good.
That was good.
And then everyone always loves that one.
Right. I love that. Then the next time I was called up, I actually did, make it as far as getting
having to spend the morning there or the day there.
I spent the day there. I almost got impaneled.
Yes.
And then it turned out that I actually knew one of the witnesses who I hadn't recognized when they asked, like, do you know any of the parties? And I said, you know, I didn't raise my hand. But he recognized me. He's a local homeschooling dad who I'd am Facebook friends with and had met once in person, but that's, you know, personal knowledge.
Yeah, so is that Adam?
Adam Morin.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right,
I did not recognize him. Like it had been a while since I'd seen him and I just didn't like,
yeah.
He recognized me. And so then I got called like to the sidebar with the judge
Do you not know this man?
Do you know him? I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess I do. I'm very sorry about that, Your Honor. Okay, you can go back and sit down now. And that was pretty much it. That was my jury experience.
I've never gotten paneled. I did get called out to, you know, have my number called and have to go in to the room and sit and go through the voir dire process where the lawyers ask questions. And I remember at the time, this is when I was working for Catholic World News. So when they asked for profession, I wrote down journalist. And that, I'm sure, was why the defense lawyer used one of his, they get a certain number of free tosses. Like, just no questions asked, they can toss, like, four people from the jury pool. And I was one of them, and I'm like, fine by me. I'm happy to go.
I think, all other things being equal, I would not mind serving on a jury. It's the, like, homeschooling mom who's taking care of the kids question that really...
My sister was on a murder trial jury.
Interesting.
Very interesting. And she was, it was right over here. It was actually over here in Norwood at the McDonald's. They, a bunch of kids killed a McDonald's employee in a robbery.
Oh, wow.
And what she found out was, like, the kid that they convicted was the kid that was driving the car. He didn't pull the trigger. He was just driving the car. He's the only one who got convicted. The others plea bargained against him.
What? That doesn't seem fair at all.
That doesn't seem just at all.
No.
But she felt really bad about that for a long time afterward. But and then they had to go to the McDonald's, see the scene of the crime. They were
sequestered. Had to go to the scene of the crime?
Oh, yeah. They load them all up in the buses and they drive them out there to see where it happened. I mean, it was a big deal. It was, I remember that. It was a long time ago, like 20, 30 years ago. But it was a long time ago. Yeah. But I don't want a murder trial because then you have to see everything. But of course, you could also get like a corporate lawsuit trial with very technical, boring.
Oh. Yeah, the one I escaped being impaneled on was like an insurance question. Mm. Like, did not sound at all interesting.
The one I got, the worst one for me was the one over here in Quincy, where it was right after I had been diagnosed with type 2. And I was still new at the whole, like, what do I do about, you know, having blood sugar? And I got there and we sat in this room and we couldn't leave except to go to the bathroom all day. There was no lunch break. Like, no, we're not letting you go for lunch because we think we might be impaneling soon. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, from like 8 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and hadn't had anything to eat all day. I was feeling really sick.
That seems really like I would be complaining to the officer of the court by that point saying, it's a health problem.
I was feeling really sick by the time that
they're lucky you didn't end up having to go to like the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like 3:30, something like that. Yeah. I mean, it was really late in the day.
Did you complain?
I was just glad to get out of there. I didn't want to rock the boat. I just wanted to go.
No, but you didn't you didn't like go up and say, you know, I need food.
Well, I kind of went up and said, you know, is there any chance that, you know, that we go? No. I'm like, I didn't want to make a big deal out of like, oh, I have type 2 diabetes. You know, it's like.
I would have made a big deal.
Well, I mean, now I might have because I'm older and crankier. But, you know,
I'm old and cranky.
Born old and cranky.
But. Yeah, probably.
Anyway, so I don't have to really worry about too much about this until June 6th, D-Day, jury day. And it's over in Dedham, where you actually had to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually enjoyed my experience there. Yeah.
I don't really want to go to Brockton, because you're more likely to get impaled over in Brockton, but it's really close by. Quincy would have been okay. Dedham's kind of far for me, but it's not as far as some, so. And it could be worse. Could get a grand jury, which is terrible. You're like impaneled for like 30 days straight. And you're once you're on it, you're there and you have to hear all the cases, all the, you know, all the probable cause hearings and all that sort of stuff. Blah. So after that pleasant news, Saturday, we finally made it to our first
winter market.
Yay. So this is New England. We have one growing season, essentially. This isn't like California where, you know, things are growing out of your lawn. Hey, I have an avocado tree. Would you like to, you know, a bushel of avocados that I'll trade for your bushel of oranges in February? You know, it's like, no, this is in New England. We have to coax food out of the ground, even in the summer. And so the idea of having a farmer's market in the winter was unusual. But the summer market we go to, Hingham Farmers Market, they started doing a winter market a few years ago where it was like in every other week, they started every other week, January and February, I think it was. This year, they've moved it to a new location, which is really nice, Wampatuck State Park, in the main building there, which has these nice big fireplaces, which is really nice. And it's warm. And it's small. It's very small. There's only a handful of vendors. And they do it every week from January through March, which is nice. That means the only time we don't have a market is December and April, essentially.
Not that we've actually gone to the winter market.
This is our first time going, yeah. Part of it is just every weekend's got something going on, has had something going on, or we're just like, oh, I'm too tired to get up and go. You know, we're so busy this week. But this week, we finally got to go. And one of the reasons I've been wanting to go is they have a new vendor selling all kinds of mushrooms.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a bit when we talk about fancy mushrooms. Cooking. Yeah. We're hobbits like that. We just love mushrooms of all kinds. And they had a mushroom vendor a couple years ago, and then she wasn't there last year, which was disappointing. And this is a new one. So we hope that she sticks around. And then we get to see our old friends who, some of them, although Elizabeth from Copacabana wasn't there.
Yeah, we got eggs.
Yep.
And we got some jams. Mm-hmm. A blueberry lavender, which was really good.
She's a new canned goods vendor, like canning.
Yeah.
Like stuff. Yep.
What else do we get?
We got the blueberry bread.
Blueberry bread.
From Baking with Joy. They're really good.
And
then Oakdale Farm was there.
Yeah. So we actually did have a farmer. He had some squash and some kale, some onions and
bok choy.
So I got bok choy and an acorn squash.
You had carrots and some other stuff, too, we didn't get.
Yeah, some greens.
Mixed greens.
I got some mixed greens. Yeah. So, yeah, it was nice.
There was a new microgreens vendor there, although they weren't at the table.
They weren't actually there.
But
they were there.
Among the other things, they sell, pet grass, which I think it's grass that your pets can eat. It helps their digestion.
Oh, it wasn't like
in the winter.
Like a chia pet?
No, not like a pet grass, but pet grass.
Oh, see, I was reading that as a pet grass.
Now that I think about it, maybe you're right. I think maybe I just assumed. But maybe it was like, hey, it's my pet grass.
Ch-ch-ch-chia.
We could get it for Lucy. It could be Luchi-ch-chia.
I don't think she would like that.
I don't think she'd appreciate that at all. And then there were a couple others there. I don't remember. There was one guy who was selling a cannoli kits, which we missed.
I did not see a cannoli kits.
Yeah, I saw it on their social media. They were showing pictures of the kits. Oh, and Jordan Brothers Seafood was there, of course.
Oh, yeah, and we got some scallops.
Yeah, and the lady from the lobster family, the lobstering family, which she was really nice. We said it before, it's so nice to go, and people are like, hey, it's nice to see you. Look how big they are. Oh, we haven't seen you in so long. You know, that sort of thing. It's just got that old-time, small-town feel, you know, just like, your friends, people you know. So it was really nice. So that was the winter market. So Wampatuck State Park is really nice because it's in the same town. It's in Hingham. It's a former, like a lot of actually state parks are around here. It's a former military base. It's actually former military arsenal where they used to make ammunition during World War II.
Cool.
So they have a little display in the lobby where they show like the different shells and the different things. And
but there's nothing left really of any of that.
I hope not.
No, I mean, not the munitions, but like even the buildings. Like
Right.
It's just woods.
It's just all woods. It's all grown over in the past 80 years. It's all gone now. But and it's a very nice little forest. And they even have a campground, which we keep meaning to, you know, it's an easy 20 minutes to go to this campground and just camp outside for a weekend. We got to do that. We got to, you know, sometime.
One of these days.
Yeah, one of these days. So that's, and then the other thing that we did was Cub Scouts. It's that time of year again. It's Pinewood Derby time. Yes,
You have to explain what Pinewood Derby is because not everybody necessarily know what Pinewood Derby is. I mean, I didn't know what it was a couple of years ago.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'd never heard of it.
I mean, I can imagine like Jocelyn from New Zealand might not know what Pinewood Derby is.
I didn't know what Pinewood Derby is.
Okay, well, Pinewood Derby is it's a very old tradition in scouting where you take these wooden block car kits. It's a block of soft pine, I think it's pine, soft light
pine,
wood.
Pine wood.
Pine wood.
Pine wood.
Maybe it's Pinewood, the Pinewood Derby.
Maybe.
Huh, now that you say that, light dawns on Marblehead. So they take these blocks of pine, funny that, and it comes in a kit with like axles and wheels, and then you carve it into a shape, you know, into whatever shape you want. There are certain rules about the shape and the minimums and the maximums, and there's all kinds of rules about it.
Lots
and,
of rules.
Yeah, but the kids, the idea is the kids come up with a design, they do as much of the work as they can. Of course, they can't use power tools, so the parents help with that. So the nice thing is that the pack has Pinewood Derby workshops for a couple weeks, which means I don't have a workshop. I don't have a garage. I don't have a basement. I don't have a shed that I can work in. So any type of power tool stuff that we do here has to be outside, which it's February. So it's nice that they do it, and they have all the tools there. And the kids come up with a design, and they trace it on the block, and then they carve it, and then they sand it down. Next week will be the painting. We're going to paint their designs on it, and then it'll be a weigh-in. They have to weigh no more than 5 ounces, but as close to 5 ounces as you can get it. And so you have these weights that I bought that you affix to the car, and then you put the wheels and the axles on. And then we'll have, in a couple weeks after that, we'll have...
let's go to the races.
We'll go to the races. So we have a big track that the pack owns, and we set it up, and I'm actually the timekeeper because I have the laptop that works with the software that runs the track timer, and we'll go. Now, this year, Lucy, Anthony, and Ben have all built cars, and Lucy has decided that she wants her car to be in the shape of a Jagdpanzer 38D Hetzer tank destroyer. It's a German World War II tank destroyer. This is what she decided.
It has nothing at all to do with watching you play World of Tanks.
It has everything to do with watching me play World of Tanks. She wanted to build a tank, and we decided on the Hetzer because it's straightforward. It doesn't have a turret. It's a gun coming right out of the front of the tank, and the shape was pretty slab-sided. It was easy enough for her to accomplish. So we had them cut the slabs, you know, the sides down, and then when we got home, I drilled into the front of the car, and we shaved down a pencil end and jammed the pencil into the, you know, glued it in there and jammed it in there pretty good.
For the
main gun. So then we'll paint it and we'll go. It'll be fun.
And Ben and Anthony?
Ben is doing a diesel train. Say it's 1930s, 40s style. So it's a smooth... there's no indents, no cutouts. It's like basically a smooth surface coming up from the nose, almost not quite like a bullet train, but very aerodynamic, which makes it a lot easier for him to do. He's very happy with that. What did Anthony, I think, is doing a car. I think he might be doing Ben did last year, like an army ambulance or something along those lines. Something
okay.
Kind of basic.
I kind of missed out on, like...
Yeah, he didn't really talk much about what his design is, so I think he's just going for maybe... I think actually that's what it is. I think he just wanted to go for, like, a sleek race car. So
right. Nothing wrong with that.
He's got a nice wedge shape going on, and it's really rounded and aerodynamic and all that. We've watched a really good video the last couple of years by Mark Rober, who has a YouTube channel. He's the guy who did the glitter bomb for the Package Thieves.
Oh, fun.
So he has a very big YouTube channel, but he's also a former scout who did this great video on the physics of Pinewood Derby and how to maximize the speed in your Pinewood Derby car. So, and one of the things he says is get as much weight at the top of the car, the back of the car, as possible. Because that's more potential energy.
Makes sense. Yeah. Hey, physics. I love the fact that
it's a lesson.
It's a fun sport, but it's also sciencey.
Now, then there's the crazy end of Pinewood Derby sport land. You can spend all kinds of money buying special jigs to put in special axles. You can buy special titanium axles online that are bent in just the right angle. You can buy special wheels that are low friction wheels, graphite.
And all this is legal?
No, most the graphite's fine, but you have to, in our district, you have to use the wheels you get in the box and the axles you get in the box. You can sand them, you can sand the edges off, but they have to maintain the same tread shape. So you can, you know, sand some of the burrs off of the axle and the wheel, in interior of the wheel, so that it runs smoother, but you can't change the shape of the wheel. Because ideally, you would make the wheel thinner, which lowers the amount of friction.
Right.
You know, so a thinner wheel is better in that case. But yeah, you can't do it. But there are people. Then there are the adult races.
So are these people who are cheating, or are they just different districts have different rules?
Well, partly different districts have different rules. Some districts or packs will do dad races, where dads can build the best car they possibly can. Like, you can go out and buy a fully done car that you just paint, uh-huh, that looks like a sled with, you know, with titanium poured into the back. I mean, just crazy.
How is that? Like, in the spirit of the
no, it's fun. It's for fun. It's okay. The dads competing against each other.
Okay. Well, I actually see a huge benefit to this, because it lets dad focus his competitive energy into his own car and
let
the kids do their own. Like, instead of dad needing to prove something by micromanaging the child's car. I can see the benefit, the utility, and especially I could see why a pack with very competitive dads might adopt that as their plan.
And there are even like Pinewood Derby racing leagues out there that are just separate from scouts.
Okay.
You know, just people who are as crazy about getting them as fast as they can and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, sure.
It's just, there's a hobby out there for everyone.
Right.
One of the guys who helps out, one of the guys from the troop that we're associated with, when his kid was a cub, he built a couple of cars, and he has one. It looks like an MBTA, you know, MS transit bus.
Uh-huh.
And he basically hollowed it out and poured lead into it. It weighs like 5 pounds. It's crazy. So he puts it on the track, and you gotta put a pillow at the other end, because it comes out of that thing like a missile out of an electromagnetic railgun. I mean, it was boom. It was so funny. But it's fun. It's fun. And the kids have fun. And then whoever wins, you know, the kids who win at the pack level, at each den level, go on to districts. And Ben went to districts last year. His car, there were two Weeblos. His car was faster, so they both got to go, or he got to go, and to the districts, and so, which was fun. He didn't win that, of course, but it's fun. And if you win a district, you go to council, and if you win a council, you go to national or something like that.
There's
National Pinewood Derby. I've never heard of anyone who got to go, so I don't know.
Well,
suppose if you win at council, they must like pay your way or something. I don't know. I mean, like, do they expect families to shell out cash to fly themselves somewhere? I don't know. Maybe. Interesting. So that was fun, and we'll update you on how the Pinewood Derby cars are going over the next few weeks. Talking about what else is going on, I'd mention that as far as learning in school, we've been working real hard with Bella. I've been working real hard with Bella, helping her get caught up on math. She'd had a little rough time with math until last year, when we decided that I would spend an hour in the morning every day with her, helping her do her math.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of the issue was just me spread too thin, and her not being able to really focus on it without somebody who was really sitting down with her. And I was just trying to deal with too many people.
When she has a question, she's stuck. She can ask me. She's sitting right next to me while I work. And frankly, I don't have to spend a lot of time with her, helping her with it. She manages to do most of it on her own, which is impressive. But she gets stuck once in a while, and then I have to kind of help her through. Well, the other thing I have to do is kind of like, hello, focus on your work, and come back to the work,
which is what I'm doing with the other four kids.
Yes. Easily distractible. But like at the beginning of last summer, she does it through Khan Academy on my iPad, which works out really well, especially with the Apple Pencil. That turns out to be the thing for her, I think. So she was at about the sixth grade level at the beginning of last summer. She's technically about she's 13, so she'd be eighth grade right now, in the middle of eighth grade. So she was behind. But we worked over the summer and through the fall and over the winter, and she is now at grade level. She is now she just passed into eighth grade a couple weeks ago, and she's already 13% through eighth grade.
Cool.
So that's she's making her way through, and it seems to me that it's coming easier to her. We skipped statistics, the statistic modules at first in the sixth and seventh, and we went back and did them and mm-hmm. and they came pretty easy to her. So I think doing that was good. At first, she was really flummoxed by statistics, but now that she's got all that other math, going back and picking it up was a good idea. So I think that worked out well. This is why we homeschool. She doesn't have to be on the same schedule as 40 other kids.
Right. And I remember when I was in, I think, sixth or seventh grade, I can't remember what specifically, I had a teacher who let us work at our own pace. Basically, you did the problem sets, and then the teacher had the answer key at the front of the classroom. And you took your paper, like your homework, and with a red pencil in your hand, you could not take a regular pencil, and you could check it against the answer key. And then you turned it in, like you wrote how many you got right and wrong. And then you turned it into the teacher. And then when you'd finished all the problem sets, if you'd passed them all, I guess, then you could take the test. And the teacher graded the test. Obviously, you didn't self-grade the test.
Right.
But you could do, three or four problem sets in a day and take, several tests a week. And so I loved the feeling of just racing ahead and then it was optional. You didn't have to work ahead. And a lot of the class didn't, but I loved being able to, instead of sitting there bored while everybody who didn't get the lesson had it explained to them again and again and again, I could just say, I know this one, and go ahead and do it. I loved the freedom.
Yeah.
Maybe I was always a homeschooler at heart, like just work at your own pace.
My favorite class in high school was like this. I took, I took a series of industrial arts classes and technical drawing. So technical drawing 1 and 2, architectural drawing. I forget what the fourth one was, but with Mr. Barati, I think it was. And that's how he worked. He would show us the concept, explain things to us. And then here are the sheets. Here's the drawings you have to do. Complete them all, hand them in as you do them. And after that, it was up to us until it was time to go to the next level of learning. But we were on our own. We were working on our papers. We could, and if you fell behind and you didn't get your work done, it was your fault. You needed to get your work done. The incentive actually was he had an Apple II computer in the classroom, Apple II computer. Uh-huh. With a drawing tablet. Like when I say drawing tablet, it was like a pen with a cord on it and the tablet, and you could draw circles and squares and triangles with it.
Ooh.
It was really advanced for the time. It had 16K of memory. Yes, ancient history. But I always wanted to get my work done so I could use the computer. But fun. So I'm glad she's catching up with that. And I think things are going okay right now with the bribing them to do their work is working some days, not as much other days. But
right, there are days when it just they're tired and they just don't want to go fast. This morning, however, Ben finished all of his schoolwork by 9 a.m.
Yep.
That I was like, he's like, can I get $2 for finishing by 9? And I'm like, sure, sure. I want to incentivize this. He's also incentivized Lucy. This was interesting. He was letting her use his iPhone, which it's not a phone.
It doesn't have phone service. It's just, it's a fancy iPod.
To listen to an audiobook. And so right.
we've given him this old iPhone that I think we've mentioned before, so that he can listen to audiobooks and listen to music on it.
Yeah. So she doesn't have a device to listen to anything on. So he was letting her borrow his, which was really sweet. And sitting with her and talking about the books with her. And it was really sweet to see him share a favorite book with his little sister and give up his time with his, that he could have been listening to his own book.
He listens to his own book a lot. So it's
right. So it was a meaningful sacrifice. And I told him how impressed I was. And it was really sweet.
How it started was he was sitting in his bed with her and each had one of the earphones in listening to the first chapter of the wizard book.
Right.
So that's how he started sharing that with her. and then let her continue listening to it, even because he'd already listened to it.
But the great thing was that he said she couldn't listen to it until she'd finished her schoolwork. And so she had a little incentive and it was a lot more effective than me incentivizing her, I noticed.
Yeah. It's funny to see how they've picked that up from you. This incentivizing each other and, you know, helping each other in this, using the same methods. Kind of funny.
Yes.
So that's learning. And so what have we been eating? Well, so we went to the winter market, as I mentioned, and we got scallops and we got all these mushrooms. So we decided to make something with those. They had the mushroom lady had. I assume that's not an offensive term, the mushroom lady. To me, that's a term of endearment, frankly.
Right.
If I start calling you the mushroom lady, then you know I mean it.
Uh-huh.
Because I love mushrooms. The mushroom lady, she had king oyster mushrooms. And I don't know if I've ever seen them before. I must have seen them before. But they've got these really thick...
I've never seen anything that
big
before.
These really thick stems, and they're about 6 inches long, and they're about 1.5 inches wide. They're both the same width of a sea scallop, which is kind of interesting. And I found a recipe, and I didn't follow it exactly because it was doing some other stuff, but that cut the stems into the size of scallops. And then this was just cooking them separate, you know, in sort of like vegetarian scallops, which I'd rather just eat scallops. But so what I did was I put them in a pan with butter and olive oil and fried them both sides, you know, so they get nice and brown, and with some garlic, cut thick, not minced. If you mince the garlic, it'll burn and it will get bitter.
Yeah, yeah.
So I took a big clove of garlic and cut it into just a couple big chunks, cooked it there, moved the mushrooms to a bowl, but left the butter and oil in the pan to get that garlic umami.
Mm-hmm.
Then add a little more butter, and then put the scallops in the pan with a little sea salt on them. And I put some sea salt on the mushrooms too. And then cook those both sides to get the browning. Then I added some wine, let that cook down a little bit. Then I moved the scallops out, and then I added some more wine, lemon juice, some more garlic, and some more butter to the sauce.
They were really good.
It was really good. And the mushrooms were really good. They're really flavorful. Next time I will cut them thicker. I cut them relatively thin when I first did it.
Right.
I think they'd be better if they were thicker.
And then I used the other mushrooms because you only used a couple of those.
Of the king oysters, yeah.
There's one of the king oysters left and some of the gray oysters, blue oysters.
I think they were blue oyster mushrooms. Did we get golden oyster mushrooms too?
No.
We didn't.
They were like little yellow Namiko mushrooms, maybe?
Oh, the Namiko mushrooms, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I used some of those in a stir fry tonight, stir fried vegetables with the bok choy that I got at the market and some broccoli and carrots and onions.
It was good. Even the kids liked it too. Ben liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a fan. So, and a good sauce. You made a really good sauce on that one.
Yeah. Very simple. Just soy sauce, wine, white wine, some chili garlic paste and rice wine vinegar. Yeah.
So the other thing that came up this week with cooking, which I think we might have mentioned, but we haven't really talked that much about this time, was you put a recipe on your blog at thewinedarksea.com.
By request from a friend.
Yeah. For almond flour lemon muffins. Because this is a muffin that you make for Ben to have for breakfast, but Lucy can eat it too, right?
It started off with making almond flour muffins for Lucy because she's allergic to eggs and dairy, but she's not allergic to them when they have been baked and denatured. She's supposed to eat baked eggs and dairy daily. We usually aim for several days a week because we can't really get her. She's tired of muffins. She's tired of having to eat muffins for breakfast, and she really just would like a bowl of cereal or something, please. But I'm mean, and I make her eat a muffin several times a week. And all the other kids are like, I want to eat muffins for breakfast. And eventually, I sort of caved. Ben was just really struggling. And,
Finding something to eat.
Finding something to eat. He's
He'll have a bowl of cereal, but he'll still be hungry. He needs second breakfast.
Yeah.
And finding something that he's willing to eat.
So I make these with almond flour, which makes them really high protein.
So very low carb, very high protein.
Yeah. They do have some tapioca starch, which makes the helps to make them fluffier. And then I add powdered milk, a whole stick of butter for 24 muffins. Sometimes I use coconut flour and ground flaxseed and a whole bunch of lemon zest.
And for the baking powder, you make a homemade corn-free baking powder because most baking powder, commercial baking powder, has corn starch in it, right?
Yeah.
Right. And Lucy's, again, as we've said, is allergic to corn, so that's out. So flaxseed, a little nutmeg, sugar, zest of the lemon, lemon extract, the lemon juice too. Do you do lemon juice?
No.
Okay. That would make it too wet.
Yeah, it's way too wet. So you really want to control the moisture.
Because almond flour is very rich. That's because it's a nut, so it has a lot of fat, so it makes it very rich and moist.
Yeah. Coconut flour tends to be thirsty, so if I use that, then I end up adding extra liquid. Usually just some extra milk.
Mm-hmm. Because you do milk powdered milk and regular milk?
Yeah.
But the powdered milk is to get more milk into Lucy.
Right. To get more protein. Well, also, making a higher protein muffin for breakfast, you know, fills them mm-hmm. up a little bit more. Make sure they...
Yeah. Now, as far as the sugar goes, like, yeah, it's a cup and a half of sugar in 24 muffins, in two dozen muffins. So it's not low sugar, but it's not a lot of sugar given everything else that's in it.
Right. I mean, a lot of muffin recipes use like a cup of sugar for 12 muffins. So this is definitely less sugar than that. I mean, proportionally.
Yeah. And our kids do not get a lot of, you know, sugary processed foods otherwise. So it's not, we're not too worried about that. So I'll put a link to the recipe in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets.
As I said on my blog, I tend to actually cook kind of like an old grandmother, which is not really slow, but that I cook a lot by feel, by sort of estimation. And so when I write down a recipe, it's sort of an approximation of what I kind of remember that I did.
If it looks too dry, you add a little milk.
Right. So this is one of those recipes where if you're decide to try to follow along, you know, go with your gut. If this looks like this looks way too dry, it probably needs more milk because I probably like underestimated how much milk I put in. Or if it looks really wet, add another spoon or two full of flour because I probably, you know, got something wrong.
Right. Yeah. These are not tested in the sense of, you know, you've made these muffins dozens of times. But the amounts you've written down have not been tested and have external testers and all that sort of stuff like recipe sites like America's Test Kitchen does. This is just, you know, what you've written down for notes for yourself.
Of course, I think a lot of cooking blogs actually are like that. They just don't really, they're not very transparent about it.
The key, the best thing with cooking is when you get to the point where you understand ratios, you understand how things are supposed to look and feel. And you start to cook by feel and by eye and by taste. And, you know, the ingredients lists amounts is more like you're in this range. Unless you're doing some very precise baking. Certain some baking has to be really precise if you're making a souffle or something. But most things are pretty forgiving.
Yeah. Muffins. And I've read dozens and dozens and dozens of muffin recipes. And it's amazing the variations, like how much sugar, how much fat, how much flour.
How much of a range you can get away with and still have something edible come out.
And you know, if you look at like, it's pretty standard. Most muffin recipes make a dozen muffins. And so you're not changing the volume very much. And yet the proportions are all over the place.
Right. So. And so it's to your taste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like a higher fat muffin.
Yeah. A juicier, richer, If you've ever worked in a restaurant kitchen or seen a restaurant kitchen, like I worked in a restaurant kitchen in high school, you see the chefs. They don't have teaspoons. They don't have measuring cups. They're throwing things in. They've done it enough. They've enough experience with these dishes and enough experience with cooking that they know how it's supposed to feel and how it's supposed to look. And that's where you want to get. But you know,
So I was going to say though about this recipe.
Yeah.
Is that I've had problems in the past with the almond flour muffins, especially the lemon ones, for some reason, they tend to kind of fall in the middle.
Mm, right.
The chocolate ones don't seem to have that problem. I don't know if the cocoa powder is just like...
It's giving extra lift?
Something.
Yeah.
So anyway, this time I decided to try a technique that I borrowed from my Amoretti cookies, which is I separated my eggs and I mixed in the yolks in with the other liquid ingredients. And then I beat my egg whites into nice,
like a foam.
Like, yeah, to a nice...
Stiff peaks?
Soft peaks, maybe?
Soft peaks, okay.
I was hand beating, so I I gave up a little bit.
Soft peaks. Yeah. No one hand beats the stiff peaks.
No. And then I folded that in at the end, and they came out perfect this time. I put a picture on my blog. You can see the beautiful...
Yeah, nice domes.
Rounded, golden brown... Perfect.
Yeah, they look good. They look good. And it's tempting to eat them, have one myself, but I don't want to deprive the children who need them.
Yeah, I usually do. Like I let everybody have a muffin right out of the oven because, of course, hot muffins out of the oven are a treat.
They're hard to resist.
And then after that, I tend to ration them, keeping them for the kids who really kind of need to have an extra protein boost, and tell the other kids, suck it up and have some toast or cereal or whatever.
When you have an allergy, you can have a special muffin.
Yeah.
So that's what we've been cooking then. So let's talk about what we've been reading or watching. So I'll just mention two things I watched. I'm still working on the Revolutionary War book, but I've been watching this series on Apple TV Plus. It's been a bit of a desert there. I'm not super impressed with the Apple TV Plus service. If I had to pay for it, I wouldn't. There's only been these two shows that I've enjoyed: For All Mankind, the space alternate history one,
mm-hmm.
and this one called Mythic Quest: Raven's Banquet. And it's a workplace comedy about a multiplayer game company. So, which
okay.
is very dysfunctional. So it's one of these,
dysfunctional multiplayer game company.
It's full of all these weird characters, sort of like The Office, or it's by the same people who do the TV show Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which I've never seen, but is very popular. But
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's you don't watch a lot of network TV.
No, none at all.
So it's this game development company that the game is called Mythic Quest. It's the vision of this one egotistical guy, alpha male guy, the creative director, who is this over bombastic personality, and the game, it's like a sword and magic, Dungeons and Dragons sort of game. And the head programmer is a woman. She's this Australian woman. Her name's Poppy, and she's sort of trying to stand up against the alpha male guy, like trying to assert herself. Then you have the executive producer, who's supposed to be the guy in charge, but he's sort of milquetoast and ends up deferring to the alpha male creative director. You have the story writer, which played by F. Murray Abraham, which is great.
Okay.
He is really great. Who is this washed up science fiction writer who won a Nebula Award in the 80s and is still riding that ever since, who eschews technology, writes the story for the game, the cutscenes on a typewriter.
Oh, gosh.
And has a bottle of bourbon in his desk, and it tells inappropriate stories.
He's basically total stereotype.
Yes. It has inappropriate stories of his adventures in the 70s and 80s, his dissolute life. You have the testers who would spend all day gaming, and other programmers, and the guy, the marketing guy, who's in charge of the selling the in-game junk, who's just all about how can we monetize everything,
mm-hmm.
So the standard warnings, it's a streaming show, so it has a lot of bad language, and they reference some sexual content, but nothing like, there's nothing graphic or gory in the game, apart from the in-game violence, I suppose, like video game violence that you see. You'll sometimes see the game doing stuff. But they do make references to various topics that everyone talks about today. So you just be aware of that. Standard disclaimer, I've only seen 8 of the 10 or 11 episodes, so maybe it goes off the rails in the next episode. Don't blame me. I haven't seen it yet. But it grew on me. I kind of enjoy it. It's fun. There was this one episode, though, in the middle, which was sort of a departure from the rest of the format.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to 1992 to this couple who meet in a video game store, this guy and this girl, and they come up with a concept for a video game, and it kind of follows. It's called Sudden Quiet Death, and it follows the development of this game and their relationship over time to it becoming one of the biggest games out there, and they have this big company, and they have conflict over monetizing it versus the original vision and being true, authentic versus, you know, that this is the same thing. They, and you know, things, I don't want to spoil what happens, but it kind of follows the whole saga of this. And then at the end, you find out how this leads into, because you don't see any of our characters from the Mythic Quest until the very end. You see how it leads to that in a way.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was actually really interesting. And
so it was kind of the backstory.
Kind of, but not really. It was a sort of a side story, which was very interesting. But it was kind of touching. I think I kind of liked it. I thought it was a nice, there were some nice elements in it. So I thought it was kind of cool. So that's one thing, Mythic Quest, Raven's Banquet on Apple TV Plus. Then I watched on Disney Plus, Toy Story 4, which I hadn't seen in the theaters. Toy Story 3 Toy Story 3 should have been the end. Andy's grown up, you know, hands off the toys to the next generation. We all cry because all the parents cry because Andy's no longer a boy with his toys.
Uh-huh.
But, how can this be good? Well, it actually was pretty good. This was...
So a new kid?
New kid who owns the toys, and the toys from Andy are, they're trying to adapt to life in a new situation, and you know, under they've moved in, and the toys who are already there are sort of this have seniority. It's kind of funny, and Woody is trying to adapt and trying to take care of this Bonnie is the girl. It's a girl now, and she's going to kindergarten, and at kindergarten she makes a toy out of we saw the short of the Forky.
Uh huh.
She's got a spork and some pipe cleaners and, you know, some various crafts and googly eyes and clay. And she makes this Sporky. And when he's first created and wakes up as the toy, mm-hmm. he's like, trash, trash, I'm trash. I got to get in the trash. And they're like trying to keep dragging him back. Like, no, Bonnie, you're Bonnie's toy now. You're not trash. And like the whole time he's trying to jump into the trash can and they have to keep dragging him out. It was actually pretty funny. I have to say it was an inspired idea.
I liked the short. It was funny.
They have a bunch of Forky shorts on Disney Plus with him, and he's kind of dense. He's just he's a fork. He's a spork. You know, he's not a very smart toy. So,
as one might expect.
Yeah. At one point, they end up in an antique store where there's a doll from the 1950s who's really creepy. You know, Gabby. Is the doll. She's creepy Gabby, and she's assisted by her henchmen, I guess you might say, who are these four ventriloquist dummies.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's like ultra creepy. And then Keanu Reeves is in it. He plays what is the greatest Canadian daredevil motorcycle driver. He's evil Canadian Evil Knievel, but I forget what they call him, but he's got a bit of a complex, you know. He was rejected by the boy who got him for Christmas, named Jacques or something like that. It was good. Another sad ending, you know, another tearjerker ending, but happy ending.
I think I've only ever seen the first, possibly the second Toy Story. It was never a franchise that I really got that into.
You would probably look at it differently now as a parent.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think, you don't like anthropomorphizing things. You don't like when animals are anthropomorphized, especially.
Yeah. Well, especially when they mix people who are supposed to be real people
with the animals. Yeah. It's really disturbing to you.
It's just the
Rudolph talking to Yukon Cornelius is just wrong.
Well, no, those were just wrong because I really hated the animation style.
Okay.
I do not like Rankin Bass at all. Sorry.
Oh my gosh. We've just lost all of our listeners. Nobody will listen to Melanie anymore. Anyway, for the one or two people left, like your mom and maybe your dad, how about you? You've been reading a few things. Tell us what
I finally finished my massive Dresden Files
reread.
Yeah. 15 books plus two volumes of short stories. The new book is coming out this summer. I'm so excited. Peace Talks. Again, disclaimers, Dresden Files is like, it's, you know, he's fighting creepy demons and werewolves and vampires and stuff.
So scary. It's just, for some people, it might be scary.
There's scary gore, like, you know, gore.
But it's a book, so you're not like you're seeing it.
And there's definitely adult sexual content.
Okay.
Now, I like the way Butcher deals with it. I mean, there's some stuff that, like, scenes that could have got cut. Okay, sure. But in his world, sex actually has consequences, like, in terms of...
It's never just casual.
Well, sometimes it's casual. Well, I mean, let's face it. It's our world. But sometimes the casual ends up playing out in terms of plot device, including...
That's what I mean, yeah.
Right. Including some interesting sort of magical ways. I really like the way there's this one bit that with vampires that has to do with consequences, that's just really an interesting plot device that I really liked. Mm. That again shows that there's consequences to sexual relationships. And one of the major themes in the series as a whole is the idea of the consequences of your choices, including unintended consequences, and making sort of the wrong choice for the right reasons, the right choice for the wrong reasons, or what seemed like a good choice or the best choice you could make at the time, but still having to deal with the fallout and the consequences.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's good. And the short stories were really fun because the series as a whole is told from the first person point of view. It started off as a hard boiled detective novel. And it still has the kernel of that. That's the kernel of the genre. So there's the first person narrator. And some of the short stories in the collections are first person point of view from other characters, including there's a bit where Harry's dog gets to have a little narration. I love that. It's a magic dog. He's very smart.
It's a talking dog.
No.
But he talks to the reader.
He talks to the reader. He doesn't talk to
But that's characters. Okay.
Well, yeah, because he's a magic dog.
As opposed to all the other magic creatures. Never mind. Moving on. I have decided that I probably should read the Dresden Files at some point.
You really, really should.
My sister took
her years to convince me, and it was sort of a combination of my sister saying that it was good and some of my friends from college saying it was good and some other friends, and I was like, okay, fine. Everyone keeps telling me I should read this. I'll read it. I probably won't like it. And the first book was okay. The second book was okay. I think it really hits its stride about book four, but you really have to read the first few books. Just they're important.
That's a commitment.
No, I mean, yeah. They're not bad, but they're very much sort of standard genre where your genre is hard boiled urban fantasy.
Yeah.
With werewolves and
hard boiled detective urban fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun.
Cool.
So I finished that. I've started a new book, and I'm trying to get a little bit more serious now. So I'm getting back into my history reading. I picked up a book called The Silk Roads, and I can't remember the author's name. I think it's Peter, starts with an F.
The Silk Roads by Peter Frankopan.
Frankopan, yes. So it's a history book, and his thesis is sort of that the Middle East, Mesopotamia and Asia Minor and that area is really sort of the center of history.
It's the center point of the rise of Western civilization.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, like our history studies often start there. We talk about Mesopotamia and the Tigris and Euphrates, the cradle of civilization. And then very quickly, we sort of jump over to Egypt, and then we jump over to Greece, and then we jump over to Rome, and now we're stuck in Europe for pretty much
the rest of our history studies. Yeah.
Now, I like the story of the world that I've been using with the kids because
the book called The Story of the World.
Right. By Susan Weisbauer, which really does try to, on an elementary school level, get into a lot more of the world history. But I'm really looking forward to this book because he really places the Silk Roads, the connections between the East and the West, as the center of gravity for history. And Europe, what's going on in Europe, until you get to Columbus and Da Gama and Magellan and the great age of exploration, really, Europe is on the fringes of what's going on historically.
Right.
It's a really interesting way of looking at history, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm so far, I'm on like page 12, talking about Alexander the Great. But
the Silk Roads being that, like the traffic, the commerce along the Silk Roads being the veins that carry the lifeblood of civilization,
right? All those,
from Asia to Europe and back,
right? All of those civilizations in there, the countries that we think of as sort of the has-beens, fringes, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, like these countries seem to be very off, out of the middle, in the middle of nowhere to us in the 20th century, but for so much of history, that was where
stuff was happening.
That was where the action was. That was where civilizations were colliding, empires rising and falling, cities, great cities, learning, all sorts of stuff. So it's a fun, different history, and I'm looking forward to spending some, probably quite a few months with this book, because it's about 500 pages if you don't count the appendixes and the notes and indexes and stuff.
Well, that'll be fun to... Yeah. It'll be a few months before you get to the end of that.
And I'm probably going to read this. This is one of those books that I'll probably read at the pace of 2 or 3 pages a day, tops.
Right.
I'm not going to plow through it.
Because you're going to be reading 3 other books at the same time?
Yeah, I tend to do that. When I'm reading a history book or a serious nonfiction book, I tend to read it slowly and digest it slowly. And then, yeah, read other stuff on the side that looks like lighter, that doesn't requires so much out of me. And I don't know, Lent's coming up, so I'll probably pick up some spiritual reading for Lent.
Yes, Lent is coming up next week, a week from today as this releases. So yes.
Yeah.
So that's what we've been reading and watching. We were going to talk about something you read yesterday online, some Catholic spiritual reading from Mother Sophia of Mount St. Mary's Abbey in Wrentham here in near us.
We've read stuff from her before. One of my favorite things to do on a Sunday is actually to go to the Mount St. Mary's Facebook page and see what they've written as reflections on the day's readings. And often, like, she'll just take like a very little passage. It's a very Lectio Divina, just take a verse and then expound on it.
We've mentioned her before, Mother Sophia. Yeah. She's young for to be an abbess of an old Trappistine monastery. I mean, this is a monastery old, not by the grand scheme of things, but there are nuns there who are 50 and 60 years her senior that elected her to be abbess. She's only been in the order for 5 or 6 years at most, I think. And she's like, I'd say maybe 30. She's young.
Yeah.
Yeah, she looks young. So this was on the Matthew 5:21-22, where it says, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to your ancestors, 'You shall not kill, and whoever kills will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment." And so what was it that caught your eye?
Well, first of all, I really loved what she says. She says, when Jesus says, "But I say to you," it becomes clear we're in the presence of the lawgiver himself, who comes to reveal to us the beating heart of the law in his own person. The deepest meaning of the law against murder is the call of transformation of heart. Long before the point of taking a life is reached, there are interior movements and choices for which I'm responsible. Taking its cue from this word of scripture, as well as from experience, the monastic tradition is strong on the dangers of anger. So this is really her focus. Anger as a passion. It represents a deformation of a natural and good energy of the soul. So she says that the good and natural purpose of anger is the energy to stand against evil. But deformed from its original intent, we turn it against our neighbor and it's opposed to love.
It's interesting that like there is a good anger. There is a righteous anger.
Right. I mean, God in the Old Testament is often angry.
Right.
God can't be
evil or
deformed in any way.
Yes.
So
the, there is a righteous anger to stand against. Energy to stand against evil. I was thinking about, I just want to repeat there because it's an interesting concept to think about.
Right. But she says, so then anger, though, when turned against our neighbor, is a poison, a deadly poison, which blinds us to the truth. And separates us from God.
Right. And our brothers and sisters.
Right. So she says, there's a tendency to take the prohibition against anger as an impossible burden, something we can't live up to because of our human weakness, because anger is something that seems to happen to us. It takes over ourselves. We lose control of our words, our deeds. We can feel like we're slaves to our anger rather than something of which we have control or can be held responsible. So then she for the rest of her essay, which I'm not going to try to read the whole thing, she looks at the teachings of John Cassian, who shows us how to acknowledge and accept our anger as a fact of experience, as part of our nature, while at the same time making it clear that we can choose not to allow ourselves to be carried away by it. We don't have complete control over the thoughts, but we have a choice as to whether we let the thoughts linger, to influence us, to influence our conduct. So she talks about the distinction between the feeling of anger, which is spontaneous, and the choice to feed the flames, to remain angry, to act in anger.
Right.
She goes through, I think, 6 points by John Cassian. I'm not going to go through all six, but the one that really caught my attention was the fifth one. We should desire to calm the anger of a brother that a brother may have conceived against us, even if his anger is groundless. Just as much as we would desire to calm our own anger, knowing that the other's annoyance will be as dangerous for him as if as our anger would be for us.
So being in anger that is sinful, an unjust or unrighteous anger, is dangerous to us spiritually.
Right.
And also emotionally and mentally. But it's dangerous to us, especially when we feed it. And we need to recognize that someone who's angry with us, even if it's an unjustified anger, even if we're in the right, that anger that they have against us is dangerous for them. And so we need to, in love, help them overcome that anger, even if it means we have to swallow our pride and take the blame or whatever it is.
Or just to be peacemakers. I mean, this gets to the Beatitude, blessed are the peacemakers. And I love this. We are our brother's keeper. We are responsible for our brothers and sisters because it's our job to help them to grow in virtue. I mean, she's specifically talking about the context of a monastic community where all of the members are a family, brothers and sisters. And so this speaks to me, especially of the way we deal with our families. But it should stretch out to how we deal with the wider world. Now, obviously, we have less responsibility for a stranger than we do for a brother or sister.
Or a child. Or a parent.
Right. For an immediate family.
Husband or wife. Yes.
But she says, this crucial point goes very against the grain. The idea that I'm responsible for somebody else's unjust anger against me. Like,
I'm responsible not only for my own anger, but for their anger against me, too.
Right. For something that somebody else has against me. I am my brother's keeper in a way more profound than previously imagined. I may not be accountable for others' feelings or choices, but I am to be held accountable for their spiritual welfare, insofar as I may abandon them into temptation by my action or neglect. So we see our brother being tempted. We can choose to neglect them. We can choose to not take action or to take positive action to feed their anger. And insofar as we choose to turn our backs on our ability to abandon them into temptation or to help pull them out of temptation, we have a responsibility to the person who is angry with us.
Right. And this can apply to other spiritual matters as well, which we won't necessarily get into. But you can imagine we are responsible. You know, when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, love your brother as yourself, this is what he means. If you're going to take care of your own spiritual life, you would need to be just as concerned with their spiritual life. This is what godliness is. This is what holiness is. This is the way of perfection, that you need to care for others in all the various ways of holiness. And in this case, specifically with anger, but in other areas of...
Right. And so there's a natural bitterness when somebody is angry at us, especially unjustly, that we may be required to transcend to see if we can be the one to take the first step in reconciliation. And I think that this is, of course, there are fake apologies and pro forma things, but she's really talking about the heart of loving your neighbor.
Right.
Now she does make a point, this is not a call to be a doormat or to let other people abuse us. That's obviously not what...
That's not the Christian way. Doormat is not the Christian way.
So you're not responsible, like if in a case of an abusive relationship, you are not responsible for the anger of the person who is abusing you. That's not what she's saying, just to be really clear. But in terms of how can I seek reconciliation? How can I seek love? And especially I'm thinking as a mom looking at my children, very often I am called to adjudicate fights.
Right.
And I do often stress to them, look, you didn't intend to knock over your brother's block palace. You were just walking by and you happened to brush it with, the blanket you were wearing as a cape. But your brother is heartbroken because he spent a lot of time working on that and he's angry at you. You have the ability to help him to appease his anger, or you have the ability to make this into a fight and stoke his anger.
Right.
So the virtuous choice is to try to help him, to apologize. I'm sorry. I didn't see it. I didn't mean to knock it over. It was an accident. Those apologies matter. And I say, I stress to them over and over again, apologizing doesn't mean that you were in the wrong.
Right.
Apologizing is merely saying, I see that you're upset. I've hurt you. And I'm sorry that you're hurt. I want to help heal that hurt.
Yeah, I was thinking of something. That the image of the children distracted me for a second. But there's a reality where we have to. Okay, I remember what I was going to say. When you talked about, like, if you're in an abusive relationship, the thing is we have to be peacemakers within the context of what we're capable of doing.
Right, and sometimes
that's the key.
And sometimes taking responsibility for your brother's anger means getting the hell out, leaving.
Right.
Right. It means
removing yourself as a trigger.
Removing yourself as the temptation to their anger and saying, I am not going to let you hurt me and I'm not going to let myself be a victim. I'm stepping away and you need to get help with your own anger issues.
Right.
That's perfectly legitimate way of loving your neighbor.
Yes.
So she sort of concludes that this is not pie in the sky. We struggle, we fight, and sometimes we lose the battle. So she's not saying we're all going to be perfect at this, but in the midst of it all, we learn some important tools. Never act in haste. Try to cut off the negative train of thought. Remember that we are in a relationship with a brother or sister before God. When you can, act to reestablish communication and peace. This often involves waiting for the opportune moment, both for oneself and for the other. The struggle against anger is the task of a lifetime, and it's also the opportunity of a lifetime to learn the contours of one's inner world. If calm is the best way to help one who is angry, calm is also the best way to help oneself in anger. We find that we can observe the part in us that's angry as if from the outside. We can say to ourselves, Yes, you're angry, but you know that if you run off and do what you want to do, you'll make a big mess and regret it later. So sit tight, wait it out, and see if the sky is clearer in the morning.
Right.
I really like that. It's Benedictine spirituality really speaks to me very deeply because Benedict imagined the monastery as a family. And so I think Benedictine spirituality is very close to the way families work. It's got very often applicable to family life.
Yes.
As parents, we sort of stand in the same place as the abbot or abbess, who are referred to as mother or father. They're the spiritual parents of the monastery. And so we do have this role as parents, as Catholic parents, of formation. We have these souls in our charge and we are responsible for forming them. So I'm always looking for these nuggets of wisdom to help me as a parent grow in holiness myself, but also to grow in terms of how to shape and form our children.
I have a friend, by the way, who approached me with an idea that is percolating for a podcast on Benedictine spirituality for the family.
That would be really cool.
It would be really cool.
I'm really about that, all about that. Of all of the spiritualities I've encountered and experienced, the various charisms, I think the Benedictine spirituality speaks to me in a particular way.
Good. All right. I know we're going a little long, but I do want to cover some feedback, an email we got from a listener, because it's a good email, and I love getting feedback. So this was an email from Lee, who wrote when we were talking about the problems we were having with how our house was renovated by the flippers who sold it to us.
Oh, yes.
Says, I had to laugh a little when I heard you talking about your home's previous owners. I was in the remodeling business in the 90s. Man, have I seen some real head shakers. What caught my attention was the electrical outlet situation. I'd never heard of that installing them upside down was a sign of renovation. That's what I'd been told.
Right.
That's interesting. When I was in the business, according to the National Electric Code, either way is acceptable. So it's just the preference of someone, perhaps. Then we talked about like how I miss grilling in here in New England. Mm-hmm. It's hard to, unless you go with propane, which we don't have a propane grill
anymore.
That's a whole nother story that we'll get to another time. We have a charcoal grill and that's hard to do in the winter effectively. So he says, I too have the winter grilling blues syndrome. One thing I found in a January hamburger craving fit was broiling. I don't know if you guys broil much or not, but it works well for hamburgers. I do okay with steaks, but have to watch more carefully because they're too expensive to mess up. For hamburgers, I pat them out as normal, kosher salt, black pepper, olive oil on a broiler pan, approximately 6 minutes each side. The recipe I had said 4 inches from the element. I think that's too close. I dropped the oven rack down one slot from that height. They really taste and smell like grilled burgers.
I have to say, I'm intrigued. My experience with broiling was that it made a gigantic mess in the oven and it left everything spattered with grease, which smoked.
And in our house, which has really bad ventilation, that kind of smoke, it means smoke detectors going off.
So I don't know if I'm maybe not patting them enough. I think the broiler, I don't know.
The broiling is going to be, it might work. We could try it. But I don't know. I'm a little leery of smoking out the house because we've done that.
so many times we've done that.
Yeah, sometimes worse than others. I've done it. I did it recently with a lot of smoke, which is not fun. Then he ends by saying, would you guys ever consider compiling a cookbook? I've tried several of your recipes and they were very good, but would love to have a book to follow along with.
Maybe sometime in the future. Someday. That sounds like a lot of work.
I mean, it would be fun to have a cookbook.
It would be.
But a cookbook, as I think I mentioned earlier, it requires testing, a lot of testing and retesting and making sure. Because I don't want to put a recipe out there in a cookbook, especially if I sold a cookbook. You know, it's one thing to post a recipe on your website, but if I'm selling it and someone's buying it, I want that to make sure that they're going to be able to replicate it and do it right, that I've got it right.
I always kind of feel like when I put up a recipe, I should throw out some caveats like I'm not really carefully recording amounts. I'm guesstimating a lot of times.
Right.
And that's very often, like I said earlier.
Most cookbooks have third party cooks who do test that and correct amounts and stuff like that. So, I mean, What we'll do is we'll, as like Melanie did this week, we'll put recipes up on our websites. I put my fluffy pancake recipe up on SQPN.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did. Cool. I put it on the show notes. I'll put a link to Melanie's almond lemon muffin recipe. So we'll put the recipes online. The other thing is, I don't know that we have enough original recipes in such a form that I'd feel comfortable like saying this is a cookbook. But, you know, maybe someday as we gather things together, it would be fun.
Yeah, I won't rule it out. I just don't see it in the short term.
If a publisher would like to come along and give us an incentive and help us to put one together, we'd happily listen to their pitch. Thank you, Lee, for your email. Yes,
thank you very much. And, I'm very flattered.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you've tried some of our recipes. That's really exciting.
Yeah, actually, I'd be curious which ones you tried and how they turned out. Anyone who's listening who's tried any of the recipes, I'd love to hear.
Yes, yes. Please share your recipe stories. I love them.
Or if you have original recipes. Anyway. I do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Lee H., Drew M., Matt and Jess L., Joe D., and Marissa F. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. Like I said, if you had any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets, that's BETTS, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And as I said before, all of the relevant links from our discussion, including the links to the different Mother Sophia and the other things we talked about, they'll be in our show notes as well on sqpn.com. If you have not yet done so, if you've gotten this audio file some other way, subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, any of your podcast app, you should be able to do it. Or you can go to YouTube to subscribe, where you should also hit the bell to get notifications when new episodes are up. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.